We've seen many dire predictions about the impact of AI on labor markets recently. We've heard, for example, from Dario, CEO of Anthropic, that AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs. This isn't entirely new. In 2016, Geoffrey Hinton, one of the pioneers of AI, said, "We should stop training radiologists now." It seemed like algorithms were about ready to take over the full job. With AI models able to detect pneumonia on chest x-rays more accurately than expert doctors, according to benchmarks. Yet, here we are in 2025. Hospitals are hiring more radiologists than ever, and their salaries are higher than ever before. While the algorithm performed well on benchmarks, it couldn't yet replace the human. So what's going on? It turns out there's a big gap between AI in a benchmark and AI in the real world. And understanding that gap, asking, how does this new technology actually impact workers and their productivity, is important for knowing what we'll see happen in the world. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a Vox Dev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Dina Musa, a researcher and grantmaker at Coefficient Giving.
And I'm Oliver Hanney, managing editor here at Vox Dev. In this episode, we want to equip you with the tools to think like an economist about artificial intelligence, to go beyond the hype and the headlines, to ask the right questions about how AI will impact our economies and societies. By the end of the episode, we hope to have given you a few core rules of thumb and mental models to think about the impacts of AI. If you've been regularly reading the news recently, you will have come across many headlines declaring AI has passed this medical exam, or ChatGPT has scored in the top 10% of this maths exam. These feats sound impressive, and there's certainly a lot of celebration by computer scientists. But the one thing we often miss in these stories is a different question, which is, how does that translate into the real world? Anton Koronek is a professor of economics at the University of Virginia and a leading researcher on AI's economic impacts. And he's a perfect person to help us cut through the noise. Anton, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Hey there, I'm excited to be on air with you.
Anton, you've been working on the economics of AI for almost a decade now, well before the release of ChatGPT-3, which kind of thrust AI into the public view. What drew you to this topic originally?
Well, I'll have to say I've been really interested in artificial neural networks and in neuroscience back already when I was an undergraduate student in the late 1990s. And back then, neural networks couldn't do very much yet. So in the end, you know, I decided I'd become an economist. And that was interesting. That was fun. I don't regret it. But then in the 2010s, when I saw all the breakthroughs in the space of image recognition, I thought, artificial neural networks are starting to become really useful. And I always had this fundamental, I guess, notion that the intellectual capabilities of our brain are also based on neural networks. So, and of course, the biological structure that our brain has, which is in many ways very different from what the modern AI systems are doing. But in some ways, they were still inspired by the structure of our brain. And so I guess I always had the notion that as we manage to kind of harness the power of artificial neural networks to replicate more and more of what our brain is doing, that our artificial intelligences are going to become more capable and are going to become better. And, you know, back in the 2010s, I started to see that process happening. I would have never expected how fast it's going to advance, though.
And was there like one specific moment where you kind of realized, okay, I'm going to go from researching what you were working on previously in economics to kind of exclusively focusing on artificial intelligence?
Well, at first, it was kind of more of an interest of mine that I started to study on the side when I was not doing economics work. And then probably the one single moment when I decided I want to devote more of my professional time to studying these questions was actually something very personal, and was the birth of my first child, which made me think, wow, these things, these artificial intelligences, they're going to become more and more capable over time. And during the lifetime of my daughter, they are going to become probably very powerful. And I want to think about what that implies for her world. And that's when I decided I want to start pivoting my research to these questions. I never quite expected how much AI is already affecting kind of my lifetime and not just my daughter's lifetime.
So, Anton, for those who want to keep up with the news on AI in a discerning way, let's talk about some useful rules of thumb. So one gut check is that big user numbers doesn't necessarily translate to economic impact. Anton, when you hear an AI tool has tens of millions of users, for example, or might have written a high percentage of code, what do you think that actually tells us?
I think you're absolutely right that big user numbers don't imply big economic impacts. And one place where we can see this is, you know, since the digital economy started to take off, let's say in the 1990s, we've had lots and lots of things that had big user numbers, and very few of them have had any noticeable economic impact. Let's take lots of different social media. The economic impact of those is actually relatively minor. And right now, it looks the same with AI. We have huge user numbers, and we don't see a lot of that in the reflected in economic statistics. But I do want to kind of emphasize that what our economic statistics measure and what matters for us and what matters for our lived experience, it's two different things. In some ways, our economic statistics were designed in the 1930s after the Great Depression to kind of measure an industrial economy, to measure how many widgets and then, you know, later during World War II, how many tanks our economy can produce and how we can keep track of all of that. They were really not made for a digital economy. And also they were never really meant to perfectly track human well-being. So I guess the first gap between the industrial economy and the digital economy, that's something where statisticians are trying to improve their measurements. The first basic problem is that so many digital goods that we as consumers or also workers employ are actually free. And GDP, for, you know, reasons of that's what was kind of the best available compromise when we tried to measure the industrial economy of the 1930s, GDP is centered on measuring the market value of goods and services produced by our economy. And if you receive something that's free or that's almost free, like let's say web search, social media, and nowadays a lot of LLMs, then they don't enter our economic measurements by design. So the second kind of big gap is the difference between economic measurements and our subjective well-being. You can see this in things like if somebody gets cancer, they spend sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars on treating that person. Do they feel better than if they never had cancer? Of course not, right? So GDP measures something that actually reflects that somebody is suffering, that somebody is much worse off. But that's kind of design flaws of GDP. And there is a whole range of reasons. There were so many compromises that people had to make when designing GDP statistics. And that was kind of one of the downsides of these compromises. So I think we should always remind ourselves when you see economic statistics that their primary purpose is not to measure our well-being. And I guess I imagine I can say that for all of us on this call, our lived experience is that modern AI systems having intelligence at a fingertip really has revolutionized our lives and is really changing the way that we perform work on a day-to-day basis. And based on that, I guess that tells us that even though we don't yet see very much in GDP, these things are actually quite impactful.
Our second rule of thumb is not mistaking benchmarks for real-world performance. This links back to Dina's earlier comments on radiologists. Anton, why do these benchmarks seem to get so much attention from computer scientists? And why do economists tend to care about other measures?
There's a good reason why they get so much attention. If you want to make progress on something, you first need the technical benchmarks that tell you whether what you're doing is actually improving. And from a purely technical perspective, it has to be that way. I suppose it should be that way. In some ways, whatever we measure is what we can optimize for. And if you have good measurements for something, you can better optimize for it. We know that deep neural networks are amazing optimizers. So if we design good benchmarks, we can better work on improving these systems to pursue those benchmarks. And this is true both for the artificial neural networks. It's also true for us as humans. If we have benchmarks, we have something to optimize for. Now, as you say, the benchmarks that technologists are pursuing are different ones than the ones that economists generally care about. Economists measure things like GDP. I can tell you, I also care about general well-being. But since we are economists and we look at the world through that lens, GDP is, you know, one of the best measurements that we have. And as we discussed before, it's not a perfect reflection of well-being. But for example, if GDP declines because we have a recession, that tells us that something is wrong. Now, about the gap between the technical benchmarks and the economic implications of essentially any technology, but in our context, artificial intelligence, I think part of that gap is a question of timing. So what we see repeatedly is that if you develop a new technology, whether that's, you know, spinning and weaving machines or electricity or now neural networks, artificial intelligence, it usually takes a number of years, or with those prior technologies, sometimes a number of decades for the technology to actually diffuse broadly, for people to figure out, how do I best use this? How do I achieve productivity gains from this technology? And it's the same with AI, although I would argue it's actually happening much faster now for a bunch of reasons. So that kind of delay is built in. And what that tells me is that even if we stopped all progress in artificial intelligence today, and we spent the next 5 or 10 years figuring out how can we use the systems that we have right now throughout our economy in a productive way, we would probably experience very significant productivity gains. That's just because diffusion takes time. Now, why do we economists care about the broader economic measures? Because if you have a benchmark running in a lab, that doesn't affect people's lives, right? And if you actually have, let's say, all office workers being 10%, 20%, 50% more productive, then that does affect general productivity, general well-being. It means that we can do more with less input. It means that we can either maintain our wealth and work less, or work the same and create more wealth to spread around in our economy. And that's why we economists focus on these other benchmarks. And that's just kind of part of the value chain. As a technology first gets developed and then diffused through the economy and adapted in all the different businesses, it kind of has to be that way.
And when a new model is released, which seems to be happening kind of faster and faster, especially with the different competitors involved. Are there any kind of key things that you look for to try and judge, okay, how big a deal is this? How much of a jump have we taken with this new release? Because obviously there's a lot of noise around every release, and it can be quite hard to figure out as just kind of a normal person who's not kind of directly involved in the process of making these models, what's actually changed, how it's going to change my life having these new capabilities.
Yeah, for most kind of normal day-to-day use cases, these models are already so good that I find it's quite difficult actually to notice the additional progress. Over the past half year, many of the kind of benchmarks that matter for day-to-day use cases have become close to saturated. And, you know, as an academic economist, I have a couple of use cases where I need to really push those models to the boundaries. And it's in those where I see the continued advancement. So, for example, the capabilities in solving very complicated dynamic economic models, or the capabilities in coding things independently for prolonged periods of times. That's where I've seen the additional progress in the past couple months. But yeah, in terms of like day-to-day use cases, let's say, help me write an email, or help me write a good night story for my daughter. I think these models have already been saturated for the past half year or so.
Let's talk about a third gut check, which applies far beyond just AI. And that correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation. Just because a trend coincides with AI doesn't necessarily mean that AI is causing that trend. It's been easy recently for journalists to attribute some worrying new trends to AI, but much harder for economists to actually establish whether that relationship is causal. One recent example has been the debate about new graduate jobs. Anton, what have you made of that? What do you think is missing in the news reporting so far?
You know, but I have had conversations on this with a number of journalists, and I think most media that I've seen report about this, they actually do portray a relatively accurate picture. And the picture is, yes, we all have kind of some gut feeling that AI is affecting the job landscape in some ways, but there's no conclusive evidence at this point. And the only places where there is some conclusive evidence is kind of very narrow defined job categories. So for example, if you are a freelancer who has been earning their livelihood by doing editing work, then yeah, you're affected. But that's a relatively narrow job category. And from a big macroeconomic picture, I think that the uncertainty about the essentially future of AI is probably a significant driver of companies saying, should we really make this investment and hire a fresh graduate where we need to spend the next year or two just training them to getting them up to speed? Or should we rather wait for a year and see if we can hire that fresh graduate then? So I think it has probably been one of the drivers, but you're absolutely right that at this point, we don't have the solid statistical confirmation of that yet.
And another one of the rules of thumb that we wanted to run by you, which again is kind of a general rule that's useful, but particularly for following updates about AI, is considering the source of the information. A lot of the loudest voices still to this day in the kind of public debate about AI are the kind of charismatic leaders of these AI companies. And when they're on podcasts and doing interviews, they'll often be asked about the economic impacts of the technology they're building. But obviously, they also have kind of a different incentive, right? Because they're trying to sell this story, this vision about their product, as well as give an answer about what might happen to economies. Anton, I imagine you've kind of spent some time with these people working at these kind of leading labs. Do you get the sense that what they're saying publicly differs a lot from what they're saying privately? How do you think about the incentives that they have as like a business person versus what they're saying about economic impacts?
That's a really important question. And I've been asking myself that a lot too, because I often hear this point that essentially, as you mentioned it, that, oh, of course, the lab leaders have a good reason to hype this because it makes it easier for them to do fundraising and. But I have to honestly tell you, my experience when I speak to like people on the ground, people who are much more like, you know, nerdy, who are doing the actual work, my impression is that they have very much kind of the same perspective that this technology is advancing really rapidly. We can't see kind of an end to the improvements in intelligence. And frankly, and you can sometimes hear that from the lab leaders too, people are scared about what this will imply for us humans, what this will imply for our societies. And nobody, neither inside nor outside of the lab, has a good answer to these questions. And so, yeah, there is, you know, a little bit of hype, but when it comes to these really big questions, whether AI will be transformative, whether they will create systems that will reach and surpass human levels of general intelligence and so on, I don't think that the pronouncements we are hearing are actually hype. I think they are quite genuine. And, you know, in some ways, I think it must be similar to like people who have been working on the Manhattan Project, and they know that what they're working on is something really big, and they're scared of the power of what they're developing. I guess, unlike with the Manhattan Project, they can actually speak freely about it and let us know about it. And in theory, that should give us as a society the ability to think about these implications and to prepare a little bit better. But yeah, I don't know how good we have been at taking that opportunity. And frankly, part of the problem is that nobody really has a very good sense of what exactly to expect and what to do about it.
So two particular economic theories I think are of value when thinking about AI. One is Jevons' paradox, and the other is the idea of comparative advantage. So Anton, when thinking about the potential impacts of AI automating some jobs, what do those two economic concepts lead you to think, or how do they help you model that world?
Jevons' paradox is the notion that as goods become cheaper because we become more productive at producing them, people may actually demand a lot more of that, and that may offset the decline in labor demand for people producing that good. And I think that is definitely something very relevant. That has been something that played out whenever a new technology was developed, starting, you know, at the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution with textiles. And I guess in the context of AI, what Jevons' paradox would mean is that, let's say, AI can so cheaply produce lots and lots of content, that means people may have higher demand for a lot of that content. And yeah, that's fair, that's good. The next step in the chain of reasoning from Jevons' paradox is that some people would say, and that's why we don't need to worry about AI's labor market impacts. And that, in my perspective, is a step too far. And the reason is the following. So in the past, let's say during the Industrial Revolution, when we had automated weaving machines, we at first had this kind of Jevons paradox play out. That means, okay, people suddenly demanded more clothes. And to some extent, that created new jobs for people working with those weaving machines. To some extent, it was also, if you were an artisan at the time, your skills became useless and you were not paid the same amount if you worked in the factory with the weaving machines, even if a job was there for you. What does this all look like with AI? I believe that in the short run, we are going to see very similar things. We will see, for example, that copy editors who have fewer freelancing jobs, they will switch to other things. And as long as AI is not at this kind of level of, let's call it, general intelligence, there are by definition jobs left that are human only, where we really, really need the human worker. And in a well-functioning economy, if you have unmet needs in one sector and workers of which there is a surplus in another sector, they will transition. Now, that is painful for them. It has always been painful. In a well-functioning economy, it's possible, and hopefully we also have some safety nets in place to ease the transition, to pay them unemployment insurance during the period that they're not looking for a new job. To, in some cases, we may want something like an AI adjustment program. For example, after some of the trade pacts that were signed in recent decades, there was a trade adjustment program that allowed people to transition into another job when they were affected by international trade. Something similar may be desirable with AI. And ultimately, as long as there are a sufficiently large number of jobs that the AI can't perform yet, we need to transition workers. And that's both desirable from the individual perspective, because that's where they will be productive and hopefully they will be able to earn growing incomes, but also from a societal perspective. At some point, however, what I'm concerned about is that this whole paradigm that we have lived in for the past 250 years since the Industrial Revolution will have to change. And if we do reach something like artificial general intelligence, then the definition of that in, for example, OpenAI's charter is that it would be machines that can perform virtually all economically valuable work. And if that happens, then the big question is, well, if you have these machines everywhere, what is left for the humans? And I guess that's what brings us to kind of the second point, Dina, that you raised, which is the question of comparative advantage. So once we have AGI, the AGI will be kind of by definition able to perform virtually all work. Now, we humans, we may still have a comparative advantage in some things. So let's say right now it looks likely that AIs will be really good at cognitive tasks, at tasks that require brains, and in the short term, not so good at physical tasks because robotics is lagging behind AI by a little bit. What that means is in the short term, humans would probably have comparative advantage in all the physical tasks. And in a well-functioning economy, people who lost their jobs in the cognitive domain may transition into more physical jobs or jobs that require a combination of physical and cognitive capabilities. Like think, for example, in medicine, nursing, you need to both understand what you're doing and do it. And that would be kind of a classical job where you have that requirement of both cognitive and physical capabilities that the AIs may not be able to perform as well as humans at first. Now, there is one big misconception about comparative advantage, though, that I want to point out. So comparative advantage is a theory that was originally built about international trade. And what it tells you is that if two countries trade with each other, then kind of by definition, by the way that the market works, one country is going to be a little better in one thing and another country is going to be a little better in another thing. So the classic Ricardian example was Ricardo observed that well, the UK, which was the leader in the industrial revolution, can export textiles to Portugal, and Portugal can export wine to the UK because they don't have the weather to grow wine as well as Portugal does. And if you do that, you have gains from trade. Now, there are two problems associated with that, though. The first one is that having gains from trade just means that both nations as a whole are going to be better off. However, if you were an artisan textile maker in Portugal, you were clearly worse off, even though your country as a whole was better off. So that means comparative advantage doesn't tell you that there aren't any redistributions. And oftentimes there can be severe changes in incomes of individual workers in the affected countries. Now, if we want to apply that to AI, what may happen is that we may see severe disruptions in the income obtained by certain types of workers. And if I had to make any informed bet, I would guess that cognitive workers are going to be affected by these disruptions in incomes, that lots of people who kind of made a living based on their brains are suddenly going to lose a significant part of their market value. So that's kind of the first big problem with comparative advantage and why we shouldn't kind of say, oh, comparative advantage will take care of it and we shouldn't worry about the disruption of AI in the labor market. And the second problem is this disruption can actually be so severe that those who lose out may no longer be able to afford their basic necessities. I hope this is not the world towards which we are heading, but just in terms of economic possibilities, you could imagine a world in which AI systems and robots and so on can produce everything so cheaply that humans who have to compete with them won't even be able to afford a subsistence income. So meaning that if you don't have another source of income, you could not survive based on your labor. And in our modern economies, kind of one of the fortuitous coincidences, I almost want to say, has been that labor has been one of the most scarce factors in the economy. If you are scarce, that means that your income gets bid up because labor is so valuable. And in some sense, you can say one of the reasons why we are all about 20 times better off today than before the Industrial Revolution is because the value of our labor has been bid up because labor has been so scarce. Now, if AI significantly disrupts jobs, that process may go into reverse. And it could happen that labor becomes so devalued that we are back at subsistence level or worse. I do very much hope that that's not the world into which we are heading, but I'm just pointing out the economic possibility of that.
A lot of your answers have gone in quite a worrying direction in terms of their implications for...
It is the dismal science.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads into my next question, which is about kind of economics and economic research itself and how you feel it's been responding to the current moment and the very rapid technological change we're seeing. Obviously, it's quite a challenging thing to research, right? It's changing so quickly, it's constantly improving. By the time you've written a paper, there's a better model out, your findings might have changed, etc. But what's your view on how well kind of economics as a discipline is responding to AI, this new technological shock? Is there anything you think kind of the discipline could be doing better or needs to kind of change as it tries to respond and produce useful insights for the general public and policymakers?
Yeah, Oliver, if I may go back to the very first thing you said, I don't want to sound too dystopian because I think it is true that AI offers so much upward potential too, that we may see unprecedented breakthroughs in science, in medicine, and if we address this potential job market disruption well, we could all be so much better off in just a couple years, certainly in a decade. So I want to point out that upward potential as well. But I think we should be aware that there could be significant disruption coming in the labor market and that we really need to focus on that. Now, back to kind of your broader question. I think you are pointing your finger on a problem that exists in the economic profession, which is that economists don't like to be speculative. But if you want to talk about a future that involves things like AGI, you kind of have to speculate. Economists have developed very solid research methodologies that allow us to ascertain, for example, what is correlation and what is causation by looking at the right data in the right way. And economists really like rigor. If you talk about something like AGI, that is by its nature inherently speculative. You and I don't know if we will ever be there. We also don't know if we may actually already be there, to be honest. Now, going back to your question, what could economics do to essentially prepare us for this possibility, but not certainty of disruption? I personally think that there is now a sufficiently high likelihood that AI systems are going to become extremely powerful and are going to surpass us humans in many more domains than what we are used to, and that this moment calls for speculative research, of course, speculative with very clear caveats. And one of the lines of work, for example, that I'm pushing is scenario planning, where we can, rigorously evaluate different scenarios about the future of technological progress, different scenarios about how fast these technologies are going to spread through the economy, how they're going to affect labor markets, and so on. Because I think having that economic or even more broadly social science perspective on all the challenges that rapid technological advances would entail is so important. We economists, we have this very rigorous and very well-informed toolkit for thinking about social and social-economic questions. And we really need that toolkit to apply it to questions of what's going to happen if AI continues to advance as rapidly as it is right now. And then, a second aspect that I was thinking about this is that the work of economists itself is also rapidly changing because these systems have become so good and so powerful. So I have an ongoing project with the Journal of Economic Literature in which I document how you can use AI systems in economic research. And this has forced me to try to remain at the cutting edge of how you can use AI in research myself. And I have to publish a semi-annual update for this paper. And I'll have to tell you, I've learned so much digging into this every couple months. And secondly, things have advanced so rapidly in the past 3 years that it is kind of breathtaking. My job as a researcher has really changed in the past 3 years. Back then, I could ask the version of ChatGPT that we had then to help me edit one sentence or one paragraph, and that was it. But it was in no way a replacement for the graduate student RAs that I typically always have hired. Today, there are many tasks where I'm like, okay, 3 years ago, I would have given this to a graduate student, but now I let the AI loose on it and it can do it much faster. And increasingly, I think we as economists can use the cutting edge systems almost as like junior co-authors. That makes our work more productive in the short term. But I can also see the writings on the wall that from my perspective, and again, this is now speculative, these systems are very close to being able to write like coherent and also fairly decent economic papers on their own. So usually the job of a researcher is first of all to identify a good question and then to execute it. Right now, these systems are really good with many parts of the execution, and we are still largely the ones identifying the important questions. But that's changing. And increasingly, AI systems are also capable of kind of making very good suggestions in that part of the process. We don't know exactly how rapidly they will advance to the point of where they can ask better questions. But I certainly wouldn't rule it out that this may happen within the next couple of years. So my appeal to all my fellow economists would be to take these rapid advances very seriously and to ask ourselves, what can we, given our expertise on socioeconomic systems, our expertise on how to manage economies and how to predict what's going to happen in economies, how can we use that to provide productive inputs to what is happening to better help our society navigate this transition and to hopefully come out of it at the other end in a way that AI has fulfilled all those utopian promises of making us all wealthier and happier and more fulfilled, and has avoided the potential dangers of severe disruption and undermining of livelihoods and so on.
This has been Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us 5 stars or a thumbs up wherever you're watching or listening. The best way to make sure that you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, all of our past episodes can be found at voxdev.org.